In the early 1960s, the editors of the magazine, The Christian Century, sent a question to 100 of the most famous literary and intellectual personalities of the day. The question was, what books did most to shape your vocational attitude and your philosophy of life? The editors were trying to map the books that had shaped the minds of their generation. C.S. Lewis was among those polled. By the early 1960s, Lewis was already famous as a novelist, essayist, theologian, above all as the author of Screwtape Letters, his radio broadcast, Mere Christianity, and for his imaginative writings. He had been on the cover of Time magazine in 1947, and for decades he had spent 2 hours a day patiently responding to the letters that poured in from his devoted admirers, hosting journalists who wished to interview him, and giving invited lectures. His books had been praised as the most interesting and important works of literature written in his century, as well as criticized as dangerous and repressed and regressive. Above all, Lewis was appreciated as a master of human psychology, for his ability to recast imaginatively Christianity in myth, and for his work in apologetics. Lewis made Christianity intellectually respectable in the modern world. As Rowan Williams put it recently, summing up 50 years of admiration, quote, Lewis's gift was what you might call pastoral theology. As an interpreter of people's moral and spiritual crises, as somebody who is a brilliant diagnostician of self-deception. In other words, Lewis made Christianity feel fresh, authentic, and relevant for the modern world. But there was a third Lewis. In addition to this Christian apologist, whose comforting, sagacious voice had been heard so frequently on the radio during England's darkest hour, in addition to Lewis the Mythmaker, the creator of Narnia, and other fantastic tales of space and new versions of old myths, there was Lewis the Scholar, the Oxford Don, the lecturer, the careful philologist who fussed at students for not looking up treacherous words and lexicons, and who wrote letters to children recommending that they study Latin until the point they could read it without a dictionary. This professorial Lewis complains in letters about modern translations suggesting that they constitute, quote, a dark conspiracy to convince the modern barbarian that the poetry of the past was, in its own day, just as mean and colloquial and ugly as our own, end quote. This was Lewis the antiquarian, the medievalist, who devoted much, indeed most, of his life to reconstructing the thought world of the past. And it's this Lewis that emerges, perhaps to our surprise, in that 1962 list that Lewis shared with the Christian Century. When Lewis replied to the editors, he provided 10 books that shaped his sense of vocation and his philosophy of life. They were, 1, Virgil's Aeneid, Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy, Rudolf Otto's The Idea of the Holy, George MacDonald's Fantasties, Arthur James Balfour's Theism and Humanism, William Wordsworth's Prelude, G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man, The Life of Samuel Johnson by James Boswell, The Temple by George Herbert, and 10, Descent into Hell by Charles Williams. Some of these books, even if they have been largely forgotten by us, make sense in light of Lewis's interest in apologetics. For instance, Arthur James Balfour, a British politician, delivered the Gifford Lectures in 1915 and attempted to show, among other things, the limits of strict naturalistic philosophy. In Miracles, Mere Christianity, and Abolition of Man, Lewis, too, spends much of his time trying to show how a materialistic or naturalistic philosophy is incapable of explaining human moral and psychological development. Then there's Rudolf Otto, whom I will mention later in these lectures. He was a German Lutheran theologian whose major work, The Idea of the Holy, was a brilliant and scholarly attempt to reconstruct the ancient world's attitude toward an experience of divinity, what Otto calls the numinous, the awe-filled and awe-full sense of the transcendent glory of the gods. Lewis thought it was vital to rediscover the Godhead of God, if you will. George MacDonald's Fantasties, as readers of Surprised by Joy know, caught the young Lewis by surprise. He picked it up one day from a bookstall while waiting for a train and instantly fell in love with the strange but beautiful imaginary landscape. Lewis's mind was drawn into a foreign world where he breathed the atmosphere of something he had never known before. We'll return to this later, too, in a later lecture. G.K. Chesterton is the writer we would expect the most on the list of those who influenced his philosophy of life and sense of vocation, as Chesterton, too, was a modern English writer who engaged a secularized public and a lively vernacular style. Lewis, he reports, was a little surprised that he liked Chesterton so much. But as he concludes, "I liked him for his goodness." Lewis adds, "In reading Chesterton, as in reading MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. God is, if I may say it, very unscrupulous." But then we come to books hard for some of us to appreciate, let alone understand how they could provide a sense of vocational formation for the man who made Christianity relevant. William Wordsworth's Prelude is a 300-page poem about the romantic poet's boyhood awakening of his spiritual poetic mission. And Lewis loved Wordsworth throughout his life, in my estimation, only behind Milton, Spenser, and Dante. And then we have even four even older works: Boswell's Life of Johnson, George Herbert's 17th century posthumously published book of devotional lyric poems called The Temple. And then even more surprisingly, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, a philosophical treatise written by an imprisoned Roman senator in the 500s AD. And Virgil's Aeneid, an epic poem written in Latin about a mythological hero, Aeneas, who fled Troy to found Rome. It was written sometime after 31 BC. What's striking, then, is how urgent Lewis felt ancient and medieval literature to be. It was not just a scholastic or academic exercise, but rather somehow these old authors felt like living friends, vital interlocutors. And Lewis increasingly felt that his urgent mission to recover how such men living in the pre-modern era saw and felt about the world they lived in. This is what I mean by the third Lewis, emerging alongside the apologist and imaginative writer. Nor is this list an isolated moment. In fact, everywhere in his writings, especially in his lectures and essays and letters, we find Lewis recommending, admonishing, urging his readers to return to the old books with a sense of reverence and attentive expectation for being nourished. For Lewis, the old books had a sense of timeliness. In one essay, he recommended that his readers read one old book for every modern one. And in another place, in a letter from 1958, Lewis told Corbin Scott Carnell that he owe many debts to modern theologians at all. Quote, "You pay me a wholly undeserved compliment for my erudition by supposing that my debts to modern theologians might be too complicated to sort out. There are hardly any such debts at all. Christendom, you see, reached me at first almost through books I took up, not because they were Christian, but because they were famous as literature. Hence, Dante, Spenser, Milton, the poems of George Herbert, were incomparably more important than any professed theologian. Later, when I had become interested in Christianity, been caught by truth in places where I sought only pleasure, came St. Augustine, Hooker, Traherne, William Law, the Imitation, the Theologia Germanica. As for moderns, Tillich and Brunner, I don't know them at all." End quote. Lewis does mention one exception. Rudolf Otto's The Idea of the Holy, he says, "I have been deeply influenced by." But what is most telling of all, to my mind, is that even in the midst of the messy and painful affairs of life and grief, Lewis habitually returned to the old books for comfort and consolation. For instance, in an intimate letter to Sheldon Van Auken after Van Auken had lost his wife, Lewis's mind could think of nothing better than to cite Boethius and Dante. Quote, "As you say in one of your postscripts, your love for Jean must, in one sense, be killed, and God must do it. You'd better read the Paradiso, hadn't you? Note the moment at which Beatrice turns her eyes from Dante to the eternal fountain, and Dante is quite content." End quote. Only a few years later, in 1961, when Lewis was suffering from grief after the loss of his own wife, Joy, his mind drifted back to the same passage in Dante. The last line in A Grief Observed is the same he had quoted to Van Auken: "I am at peace with God. She smiled, but not at me. Poi si tornò all'eterna fontana." What we find then is that medieval literature and ancient languages and the pre-modern way of looking at the universe were not just Lewis's study or his day job, but his passion, his love, his life's work, even the core of his being, his formation, his vocation. In his intellectual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis, at one point, describes three moments in which his youth, from his youth, in which he was deeply moved to spiritual longing through readings. And then he adds, quote, "The reader who finds these three episodes of no interest need read no further in this book. For in a sense, the central story of my life is about nothing else," end quote. The core of his life was encountering and responding to Christianity in its pre-modern form. Lewis thought that this passion for medieval literature made him spiritually akin to a generation he had never been born into. In his discarded image, for instance, before lovingly recreating the arguments that unfold in the Consolation, for example, Lewis said, "Until about 200 years ago, it would, I think, have been hard to find an educated man in any European country who did not love the Consolation of Philosophy. To acquire a taste for it is almost to become naturalized in the Middle Ages," end quote. And Lewis felt himself to be such a naturalized citizen. Listen, for instance, to how he describes himself in his 1954 inaugural address as the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge, an academic position made especially for him. Quote, "I will make a claim which sounds arrogant, but I hope it's not really so. I have said that the vast change which separates you from old Western has been gradual and is not even now complete. Wide as the chasm is, those who are native to different sides of it can still meet, are meeting in this room. I myself belong far more to that old Western order than to yours. Having claimed, then, that he was more pre-modern in mind and heart than modern," Lewis went on to explain how this qualified him not only to be the professor, but to be the specimen under consideration. It's a longish quotation, but it's worth citing in full. "I'm going to claim that this, which in one way is a disqualification for my task, is yet in another a qualification. The disqualification is obvious. You don't want to be lectured on Neanderthal man by a Neanderthaler, still less on dinosaurs by a dinosaur. Yet, is that the whole story? If a live dinosaur dragged its slow length into the laboratory, would we not all look back as we fled? What a chance to know at last how it really moved and looked and smelled and what noises it made. And if the Neanderthaler could talk then, though his lecturing technique might leave much to be desired, should we not almost certainly learn from him some things about him that the best modern anthropologist could never have told us? He would tell us without knowing he was telling. One thing I know, I would give a great deal to hear any ancient Athenian, even a stupid one, talking about Greek tragedy. He would know in his bones so much that we seek in vain. At any moment, some chance phrase might, unknown to him, show us where modern scholarship had been on the wrong track for years. Ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you somewhat as that Athenian might stand. I read as a native texts that you must read as foreigners. You see why I said that the claim was not really arrogant? Who can be proud of speaking fluently his mother tongue, or knowing his way about his father's house? It's my settled conviction that in order to read old Western literature aright, you must suspend most of the responses and unlearn most of the habits you have acquired in reading modern literature. And because this is the judgment of a native, I claim that, even if the defense of my conviction is weak, the fact of my conviction is a historical datum to which you should give full weight. That way, where I fail as a critic, I may yet be useful as a specimen. I would even dare to go further, speaking not only for myself, but for all other old Western men whom you may meet, I would say, use your specimens while you can. There are not going to be many more dinosaurs. Such was Lewis's commitment to those old authors like Boethius, who had helped shape his vocation and philosophy of life. Clearly, what Lewis did as a scholar, carefully digging up and reconstructing the medieval vision of the world, like some kind of archaeologist of thought, was not just a question of uncovering dead and distant artifacts, but a valid and compelling way to see and experience the world. The point of these lectures, then, is to ask, what it was that Lewis saw in the medieval world. That is, what did he find so compelling in the network of ideas and texts that made up the background assumptions of the pre-modern way of looking at and experiencing the world? What Lewis called the discarded image, or the medieval model. After that, it will become apparent that C.S. Lewis was not a successful writer of fiction and a successful apologist, despite the fact he spent so much time studying old dusty books, but because of them. We will see that everywhere just beneath the surface, in both his works of popular theology and in his works of imaginative literature, even when he feels most modern, you can find the medieval thought of Plato and Cicero and Boethius and Dante, as well as stranger and more obscure authors such as Chalcidius, Bernardus Silvestris, Pseudo-Dionysius, Jean de Meung, and Macrobius. Lewis felt that it was his vocation to bring these old books back to life, in updated forms, and make the world realize that what it had chosen to forget was still urgently needed. As you can see, Lewis was less interested in political or economic history, say, the rout of crusaders followed in the Second Crusade or the succession of medieval kings, than he was in intellectual history. To be even more specific, he was especially talented as a historian of psychology. That is, he was interested not just in what ideas medieval intellectuals held, but the vision of the world they experienced because of the background assumptions they possessed. Lewis called this network of assumptions and mental habits the medieval model, and it was his special talent as a scholar not just to dig up strange ideas found within old books, which he could do, but to reconstruct the atmosphere or environment or thought and allow his modern readers to feel its alterity, its distance, and even its beauty and attractive power. As a scholar, Lewis constantly shifts his focus back and forth from viewing the facts objectively, as it were, to trying to look with the eyes of one who would see the world through such facts. And it was this reason that the poetry was so precious to him, because it preserved a way of seeing which has now become foreign to us. As he put it, poetry can help us see what it all felt like from within, or what the ritual meant to those who enacted it. Lewis continues, "Anthropologists may describe to us what modern savages do. They may conjecture what our ancestors did. We cannot get inside it, not directly. But if that experience had infused its quality into some other thing which we can get inside, then this other, more penetrable thing would now be the only medium through which we can get back to the experience itself. Such a more penetrable thing might be provided by a work of plastic or literary art, which we can still appreciate." In other words, that literary art did more than hold on to facts. It was a frozen way of looking. Elsewhere in his essay, Meditation in a Toolshed, Lewis explained these two habits of mind, the objective, fact-seeking mindset versus the looking-from-within mindset, with reference to a powerful image. Quote, "I was standing today in the dark toolshed. The sun was shining outside, and through the crack at the top of the door, there came a sunbeam. From where I stood, the beam of light with the specks of dust floating in it was the most striking thing in the place. Everything else was almost pitch black. I was seeing the beam, not seeing things by it. Then I moved so that the beam fell on my eyes. Instantly, the whole previous picture vanished. I saw no tool shed, and above all, no beam. Instead, I saw, framed in the irregular cranny at the top of the door, green leaves moving on the branches of a tree outside and beyond that, 90-odd million miles away, the sun. Looking along the beam and looking at the beam are very different experiences." This, then, was Lewis's particular talent as a scholar, using facts in order to look along the beam, looking from that first-person point-of-view shot. Elsewhere in the preface to his Discarded Image, the Oxford scholar developed another metaphor to explain why he had chosen to publish a book on the commentaries of all but forgotten authors like Chalcidius, Macrobius, Apuleius, and Dionysius the Pseudo-Areopagite. Some, Lewis admits, quote, "prefer not to be beyond the impression, however accidental, which an old work makes on a mind that brings to it a purely modern sensibility and modern conceptions. Just as there are travelers who carry their resolute Englishry with them all over the continent, mix only with other English tourists, enjoy all they see for its quaintness, and have no wish to realize what those ways of life, those churches, those vineyards mean to the natives." End quote. Lewis connects this kind of travel with the way that many read the past. There is a type of man who carries his Englishry abroad. He complains of bad tea where he might have had excellent coffee. In the same way, there is a man who carries his modernity with him throughout all his readings of past literatures and preserves it intact. The highlights of all ancient and medieval poetry are for him the bits that resemble the poetry of his own age. End quote. But, Lewis continues, there is another sort of traveling and another sort of reading. You can eat the local food and drink the local wines. You can share the foreign life. You can begin to see the foreign country as it looks, not to the tourist, but to its inhabitants. You can come modified thinking and feeling as you did not think and feel before. End quote. Lewis's goal, then, for his students of medieval literature was to provide a tolerable outfit which could enable his readers to remain in the literature. Quote, "To be always looking at the map when there is a fine prospect before you shatters the wise passiveness in which landscapes ought to be enjoyed. But to consult the map before we set out has no such ill effect. Indeed, it will lead us to many prospects, including some we might never have found by following our noses." End quote. And this is why Lewis was so fussy about the details. As he points out, words subtly shift, so that in older books, sometimes one discovers, often after years of contented misreading, that one has been interpolating senses later than those the author intended. Thus, we need to encounter, to the extent we can, a word and the idea in its native habitat. Clearly, then, Lewis's heart and his brain and his passions were thoroughly medieval. But why? What were the Middle Ages? And what did this period of history possess which made Lewis so nostalgic for that age? In the course of these lectures, I will explore those questions. And in each of the lectures that follow, I will use Lewis's scholarship and nonfiction writing to discover a set of ideas that he found in medieval text. I will then show how these ideas shape the landscape of his imagination. In the next lecture, I'll look more closely at what the medieval period did believe in and why it was so important for Lewis.